Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. 26,000 jobs, $1.3 billion in wages, 160 factories. Alabama's booming auto parts industry seems to reflect just what President Trump promised, a sweet renaissance in American manufacturing jobs. But at what cost? According to a damning report in Bloomberg Businessweek, workers in the land of Dixie are facing low wages, little training, and devastating injuries. This hour On Point, the hard side of an American manufacturing comeback. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Is this what more American manufacturing is going to mean? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Los Angeles is Peter Waldman, reporter for Bloomberg Businessweek, who wrote the recent cover story headlined, Inside Alabama's Auto Jobs Boom, Cheap Wages, Little Training, Crushed Limbs. Peter Waldman, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
What's the context here?
So the context is going back to the 90s, even to the 80s, a large trade imbalance in automotive with particularly Japan at that point, but increasingly Germany as well at some point. And they were looking for what to do about that. The foreign automakers needed to have a manufacturing base in the United States in order to be able to manufacture so-called American cars. And the parts of our country that lured those factories was the Southeast, where wages have traditionally been much lower. There was a hollowing out of the industrial base from the demise, really, of the textile industry. And they offered Mercedes first in the early 90s, something like $250 million of giveaways, tax rebates, and all kinds of inducements. And Mercedes located its first major car plant outside of Germany in Alabama. And from there, we have several car makers who assemble cars. And as you mentioned, some 160, 170 auto parts plants that supply them with parts.
Now, I mean, you're writing about pretty tough stuff in this article, and we're going to come right to it. But it has to be acknowledged, this has produced a lot of jobs, and you're not writing about the major car manufacturers, their central factories. You're writing mainly about auto parts suppliers. What are the big makers there, and what do their records look like?
So the big automakers in the Southeast include Mercedes, which was the first one there in Alabama. Others in Alabama include Honda. Toyota has a motor factory in the Huntsville area. Kia is just over the border in Georgia. And Hyundai has a large car assembly plant in Alabama. In other places, VW has a plant, BMW. When I say other places, I'm referring to Mississippi, the Carolinas, Georgia. There are other auto assemblers. My article focused on Alabama, where the largest number of auto plants, and specifically auto parts plants, which are the ones with the more egregious safety records.
Describe the kind of pressure that these plants are under from the big automakers.
So what happens is they need their parts, obviously, and depending how their manufacturing system is set up, they need them fast. And that leads to a production system called just-in-time delivery, which is a well-known, well-tried, and successful form of parts supply of the supply chain. And it, I think, was really perfected in Japan. What happens in just-in-time delivery is the parts makers are producing the parts with no spare capacity whatsoever. They are producing all out and moving them right from their factory to the automaker's assembly line. So if you are Hyundai, you're waiting on fenders and motor parts and trim and seats and just about every part of the automobile coming from a parts supplier somewhere, usually within about 50 miles. It can move out to 100 or 200 miles, but they have to get there quickly because there's no slack in the system. There's no warehousing. They're not building up supplies and shipping them into the auto assembler when they want them. And the result of that, depending on the relationship, the contract, the nature of the manufacturer, there's a tremendous amount of pressure on the supplier to get that part there now. And the suppliers have these contract relationships that requires penalties, requires delivery or paying of a penalty. So in one case of a parts manufacturer called Matsu Alabama, that's owned by a large group in Canada, in Ontario, Canada, called the Matcor Matsu Group. Their plant in Huntsville, called Matsu Alabama, supplies parts to Honda. And if they are behind and cause the Honda assembly line to stop because they're waiting on a Matsu Alabama part, they're facing fines of $20,000 per minute.
Per minute, wow.
Per minute, potentially ruinous.
Okay, so but in Japan, where this just-in-time delivery system came from, I mean, when that was born, it was lifetime employment, pretty decent wages in Japan, and lots of training that went into those workers. You're describing something quite different here. Take us through the elements of your headline. Cheap wages. First of all, what are people being paid in these auto parts plants?
So barely minimum wage to start, and that's usually when they come in the door at an auto parts manufacturer here in the Southeast as a temp worker. As you may know, the temp agencies, Manpower and many, many others, some regional, some national, are the main suppliers of much of our industrial labor now, particularly in the first 3 to 6 months of employment for just about anybody joining one of these factories. They're being recruited by a temp. They are employees of the temp in every respect. And the result of that is the temp agency takes about a quarter of their hourly wage for the first whatever number of months that they work for the temp. So we're talking about people coming in the door at $8, $9 an hour, hoping if they can last those first 6 months and get hired full-time by the auto parts supplier itself, that they'll up that to maybe 10 or 11. And I didn't hear about anybody making more than $13, $14, $15 an hour.
Very little training you're describing here. And tell us the story of how this works. Rico Allen was 35 years old. Went to work at Matsu, Alabama, that you mentioned there, $9 an hour. He worked as a janitor because he didn't want to work on the big machines. There are a lot of big robots and machines in these plants. And he said that machines scared him. What happened to Rico Allen, 35 years old?
Well, Rico is a sad and very telling story, I think. Charming guy, dropped out of high school. He's now 35. This was, 15
What happened
years.
In the plant? Our time is short.
Oh, okay. In the plant, Rico lost an arm. He was working as a temp janitor. He had been just hired by the temp a few months earlier and was never trained on the machines because he didn't want to work on the machines. His dad had worked in that same Matsu, this is Matsu, Alabama again, that same Matsu, Alabama plant, and his dad had warned him, it's a monster in there, the safety conditions are terrible, and he said, stay away. But Rico wanted to go to work anyway, and he went to work as a temp janitor at $9 an hour, wanting to avoid the manufacturing process. One night, they were behind in their parts supplies, and they brought Rico in, and they said, hey, put down the broom, you're going to come over here and work on this press. And Rico was literally dragooned into working on a press, and didn't know what he was doing. He was installing a part, and he was such a thinly built person that the safety light system, the beam that's supposed to turn off the machine, disable it when somebody is in danger, someone's too close to the press coming
yep.
down, it came down right on his arms. He lost 3 fingers on his left hand and his entire right forearm.
Stuck in there in that hot press, his flesh burning inside the heated press for an hour before things came, surgeons eventually amputated the rest of his right forearm to avert gangrene several weeks later. You start right off with the story of Regina Elsie. Tell us.
So the late Regina Elsie was a young woman, 20 years old.
Beautiful girl.
Aspiring to be a pediatrician, got herself a year of community college on a Pell Grant in eastern Alabama, not from a wealthy family by any means, and fell in love and wanted to move out of her house and live with her fiancé, and so got a job and dropped out of her community college and put her medical school plans on hold, distant hold.
What happened that day that the robot next to her workstation broke down?
She was working on a line when the a station next to her showed a stud fault on the computer, and they called maintenance, something that they had to do frequently in that plant, poorly maintained machines. They were waiting for maintenance. Time went by, 10 minutes, 15 minutes. You could see them on a video that OSHA obtained from the factory.
Time's a waste in. Everybody's worried about it.
Impatient. She ends up picking up something like a screwdriver, walking into the protected robot area, and trying to fix the fault herself. She was had a lot of initiative, and she went in there. She did something to unjam it, and the computer sort of surged back to life. And she was pinned by a pair of welding probes, actually, that went into her body against a dashboard frame they were building, and slumped over. She was still alive at that point and conscious. Her eyes were open, and her colleagues were talking to her, telling her to hang in there. They couldn't get a maintenance person. Finally, the team leader jumped in an industrial vehicle, like a forklift, drove it across the floor, grabbed a maintenance person, put him on his lap from the break room, brought him back. This person was from a different part of the plant, had no clue how to unpin Regina.
The robot's got her pinned with these two big things, and she's just stuck there. She's not dead, but she's in big trouble.
She's in big trouble. And this young fellow they brought in, the maintenance person, was Korean. He barely spoke English. This is a Korean-owned plant that supplied parts to Hyundai. And he didn't know what to do. And her colleagues got very angry. They were pushing him, literally. Apparently on the video, you could see them pushing him into the robot cell. And he... He ran away. He just said, "I have no idea how to fix this." Finally, the emergency rescue people unpinned her, and she died the next day in Birmingham.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about a damning new report on the automotive industry jobs boom in Alabama that finds low wages, low safety, and workers too often paying the price. Peter Waldman's written it up for Bloomberg Businessweek. Inside Alabama's auto jobs boom, cheap wages, little training, crushed limbs. You can read an excerpt of his story at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can join us this hour. You're listening here. Have you assumed that when the automotive industry moves, some basic level of income and protections move with it? And what do you hear in these stories out of Alabama? Alabama listeners, tell us what you know. Does this damning depiction of automotive supply factories in Alabama sound right? And if a state needs jobs, is this what it takes now? If you need a job, would you take one of these? Here's a little bit of a promotional video produced last year by Alabama's Commerce Department to recruit more automotive companies to the state.
And thanks to a robust workforce, Alabama's in-state automotive industry is gaining some serious momentum. We're racing past milestones, breaking records, setting new goals, and driving towards an even better future.
A lot of jobs here. It is a big, big deal across the South and in Alabama in particular. Here's Mike Hertzing of Let's Talk Wheels. It's a website all about cars. He went on a tour of Hyundai's manufacturing plant in Montgomery, Alabama, where they make the Elantra and Sonata.
You can see this Hyundai plant here. It's a little noisy, but bear with me. If you look right here, you can see the robots welding the up to 2,100 welds on the bodies here.
All right, and by Peter Waldman's telling, those main factories where the cars are really put together, not too bad. But you've got a lot of auto parts suppliers where things can get pretty darn rough. The mother of Regina Elsie, who died in one of those plants or died of injuries she sustained in one of those plants, joins us in just a moment. Let me get one call here first from Montgomery, Alabama. David is calling. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to comment. Like I said, I'm out here in Montgomery, and a while back, after I graduated college, I went to work for a manufacturing plant in Montgomery. At the time, it was hard finding a job out of college. I was in education. Many people getting pink slips and weren't doing any hiring.
Yeah.
So over the summer, I went to work at a manufacturing plant similar to the one you're speaking about, and I was there for about 3 or 4 months, and it was pretty brutal. You know, when I first got there, I saw a lot of people walking around with back braces, knee braces, wrist braces, you know, older people barely getting around. So it was pretty brutal. And from that experience there, that springboarded me to go back to school and get a master's degree. Mm-hmm. And now I work for the federal government. Also, I'm an adjunct instructor at Alabama State, my alma mater. But that experience was tough. I came in as a temp. Making similar to one of your speakers said, a minimum wage of $8-9 an hour, and yep. I knew I couldn't sustain that, so it springboarded my career actually.
David took his lesson, you did, and moved on, and I'm glad your story's worked out well for you in the end, David. I really am. Sadly, not all these stories have worked out so well, sometimes because workers, you know, they're taking initiative when the pressure is on to keep up the production. And we heard the story of Regina Elsie, who ultimately, beautiful young 20-year-old, who lost her life in that plant. Her mom joins us right now from Valley, Alabama, Angel Ogle. Ms. Ogle, thank you very much for being with us today.
You're welcome, Tom.
I know that Regina had bigger plans. I mean, she changed her course, but she had big dreams. What were her original dreams, Angel?
She wanted to be a pediatrician.
And she went
she
to work in the
going
in the
back to college.
Yeah, she went to work in the plant. What? She fell in love and sort of decided let's just make a living for a while here.
Yeah, they were. It was really the only job that she could get right now through the temp service. So she went to work there, and they decided to just do that for now, and then eventually she would go back to college and do what she wanted. But mm-hmm. she had a car payment, and they had a wedding coming up. And
mm-hmm. What did she tell you about the what did she tell you about the work at the plant, Angel? When she began,
it was pretty tough. She liked the people that she worked with, but the hours were long. She always come by the house to get her feet rubbed because I massaged her feet every day. Because they hurt. She worked 12-hour shifts, sometimes 7 days a week. Hardly ever seen her. She's always so tired.
12-hour shifts, 7 days a week. That sounds, is that typical?
For them, yeah.
Were you surprised? I mean, there's the terrible story, and it's well known by now, and I'm so sorry for, I'm sure everyone listening is, for the terrible loss your family took. But were you surprised that Angel jumped in when things broke down and nobody else was fixing it? Were you surprised, I mean, that Regina jumped in to try and get things going?
No, because she liked to work. She liked to stay busy and get things done, and nobody come for help. She did what she thought she needed to do because that's what she was told to do.
How did
and, you know? I've worked in them plants. If something stops, you try to fix it.
Mm-hmm.
If maintenance doesn't come, I mean, that's they want their lines going.
You know, when a lot of people traditionally in this country think about working in the automobile industry, it's not easy work, but those were considered pretty good jobs when it was Detroit and, you know, in the golden age of American automotive manufacturing. What about now? How do you look at these jobs in Alabama, Ms. Ogle?
I think that what we have here now is they come over here and they start their business and they don't give a crap about Americans. They just care about their product and that's all they want out. Had they done their job, I'd still have my child.
How do you keep your beautiful memories of Regina with you and alive?
I wear a necklace that belonged to her. I have her car. She was the last one to touch it, so I decided to keep it, and I have tons of pictures all over my house of her.
How did the company...
The only way I get to see her, there's videos of her talking and laughing.
Yeah.
I mean...
Yeah. It's not anywhere near the same. How did the company respond when this happened?
I have not heard from the company. We got one single little bitty fake flower at her funeral. I mean, it's not that I want their I'm sorry, because I don't care less about their I'm sorry. But we haven't got an I'm sorry, nothing. We haven't heard anything.
Angel Ogle, you had a beautiful daughter. And
thank you.
I'm so sorry that her life was cut short. We wish your family well, and we're grateful to you for spending a couple of minutes with us today.
Thank you.
It makes the human cost of this when things go wrong very real, and I'm sorry you have had to bear that. But thank you for joining us. Angel Ogle with us from Valley, Alabama. Peter Waldman's been writing about the tough side of the automotive industry in the South, in Alabama in particular, for Bloomberg Businessweek. He's with us from Los Angeles. Jim Searcy is with us right now as well from Montgomery, Alabama. He's Executive Director of the Economic Development Association of Alabama. Mr. Searcy, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me on, Tom.
Automotive has brought a lot of jobs to Alabama. Peter has put a spotlight on that neck of the woods where things have gone poorly. What do you make of this view of the automotive industry in your state, Jim?
Well, let me begin by offering Ms. Ogle my sincerest sympathies on the loss of her daughter. And, you know, obviously I've read the story in Bloomberg, and she was obviously very much so a lovely young lady taken too soon. And the loss of anybody in an industrial setting is a tragedy. But in Alabama, there's a pretty clear line of demarcation in Alabama's economy. The economy that existed prior to Mercedes-Benz's decision to locate an assembly plant in Vance, Alabama, between Tuscaloosa and Birmingham in the mid-90s. Prior to that, which kind of kicked off the boom that is the automotive industry in the state, prior to that, we were very, very reliant on textiles and agriculture, and of course textiles left the state at the left the U.S. in a lot of ways in the late 90s and early 2000s. So we were, you know, our economy was struggling, and so we were fortunate enough to recruit Mercedes in here, and it kind of changed everything. Over the past 20-25 years, the auto industry has been a major driver of economic growth in Alabama. We currently have over 40,000 high-paying jobs that have dramatically improved the lives of workers, and not only the workers, but their families in the state and benefiting communities across the state, particularly in rural parts of the state that were suffering some pretty dire economic stress.
What about labor standards? I mean, that's where Peter looks. Wages, too, but... You know, he's got a pretty tough view of what's going on at the parts suppliers end of things. And I'm sure you read this, but let me read for our listeners, if I may, Jim Searcy. He says, parts suppliers in the American South compete for low-margin orders against suppliers in Mexico and Asia. They promise delivery schedules they can't possibly meet and face ruinous penalties if they fall short. Employees work ungodly hours, 6 or 7 days a week for months on end. Pay is low, turnover is high, training is scant, and safety is an afterthought. Usually after someone is badly hurt, many of the same woes that typify work conditions at contract manufacturers across Asia now bedevil parts plants in the South. Is that an accurate description of what you've got going on in Alabama in the parts supply manufacturing world, Jim?
I don't believe it's an accurate depiction. I think it's kind of a slanted view of it that I don't think that exists throughout all of the supplier networks. As I said, you know, we've got hundreds of companies in the state, three original equipment manufacturers, three assembly plants, Mercedes, Honda, and Hyundai. And so I think to say that that's just something that's industry-wide as a standard is incorrect. You know, as far as the wages go, they are. I mean, they're not as, you know, I heard you reference earlier the Golden Age in Detroit.
Yep.
When wages were much higher. Well, because of changes in the automotive industry in the last really in the last 40 years in terms of automation and in terms of other inputs and other variables that are impacted the automotive industry, you see, wages are different. And in some instances, they are low in terms of economic development, which is what our organization promotes. We address that through a number of things, actually temporary workers. When we're looking at either offer, whether we're going to offer incentives and what the value of those incentives will be, we take into that, we calculate whether we don't include temporary workers in those calculations. We also have wage standards. In most instances, there's no incentive offered if a company is going to create jobs that pay less than $10 an hour. Additionally, in some of these rural areas, going in at a $9 or $10 an hour wage, but also has a path forward to get increased wages, can often change the economy of a community.
Peter Waldman, here's the assertion that you've kind of exaggerated the dark side here. How about it, Peter?
Well, I think Jim puts his finger on a lot of important points. I mean, there is no question that it's not like Alabama or the southern states had a wide choice of directions to move. He's absolutely right that their industrial base in textiles, was disappearing. And what were they going to do? And they looked around the world and saw automotive plants needing and wanting to come to the United States. And you have to give organizations like Jim's a lot of credit for bringing them to Alabama. I think there's a lot of people who have benefited from that. The flip side, of course, are the exact issues he was just mentioning, that it's a real struggle in the global economy to bring in companies that will pay reasonable wages when they're having to compete with parts suppliers elsewhere in the world. We just don't live in an isolated economic bubble here. We live among everybody else. And what happens as a kind of broader global system is there it tends to be a race to the bottom. Your say worker health and safety, along with wages and along with benefits and hours and the whole package of things that make work worthwhile and meaningful and safe, tend to sink to the lowest common denominator, which really is these large Asian contract manufacturers. So to some degree, that's what's happened there, and it's largely no fault of state officials. That said, we all do make priorities and choices in life, and I thought it was interesting the one caller earlier today, David from the Montgomery area, said that after college, he tried to get a job in education and couldn't. And luckily, he went on and got a master's degree and is working in education. But keep in mind that Alabama, I think it's number 37 in the United States of all 50 states in terms of per pupil spending. So they made a very clear choice to spend money on attracting industrial plants that have led to the situation that they have in some respects, and not, for example, doubling or tripling their per pupil spending. And who knows, maybe Amazon would be there now instead of Adyen USA. And I think it's important to mention that name, Adyen USA. I didn't mention it before, but they are the parts supplier where Regina Elsie was killed. It's AJIN.
Where the robot killed her on the line.
Exactly.
Jim, is it possible to raise a higher priority? Can the state make occupational safety a higher priority? Can they oversee this more intently to take away some of the risk to life and limb here?
Well, the mission and the scope of what we do at the Economic Development Association of Alabama is try to improve the conditions to make Alabama as attractive as possible for companies that are considering investing here.
But one hopes that wouldn't mean you don't have to worry about safety regulations in Alabama.
No, I agree, and that's not, I mean, that would be a really bad mischaracterization of what our objective is. We want everybody to operate a safe and secure facility, and we expect the companies that locate here, whether they're automotive suppliers or whether they're aerospace or whether they're distribution centers, we expect them to adhere to safety regulations that are nationwide, and when that doesn't occur, we certainly expect them to be penalized appropriately. But as far as and to go back to what Mr. Wallman said, you're right. We are ranked 37th in terms of per pupil spending. That's less than what we should spend. One of the things that we are trying to do, though, in terms of workforce development and trying to create
a workforce that is capable and trainable to go into a variety of industrial settings is we're working very closely with our industries and K-12 as well as post-secondary to create a trainable workforce and trying to align the needs of our industrial citizens with those, you know, to create the jobs and to make sure that the students that are matriculating out of our
can do the work. Jim Searcy with the Economic Development Association of Alabama, we thank you for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Blue Apron. Blue Apron is the fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service you've heard about. Its mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to all. They support a more sustainable food system, set the highest standards for ingredients, and make it easy and fun to cook. You decide which recipes and how many meals you want each week. Change, pause, or cancel anytime. Learn more at blueapron.com/onpoint. Go now and get your first three meals free plus free shipping at blueapron.com/OP.
Hi, it's Tom Ashbrook. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to ask you about you. At On Point, we want to learn more about our listeners with a short survey. It's anonymous, it's easy, it'll just take a couple of minutes to complete. If you go to wbur.podcastingsurvey.com to complete the survey right now, we'd really appreciate it. That's wbur.podcastingsurvey.com. This survey will be really helpful to us, so thanks. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about a damning new report on the automotive industry jobs boom in Alabama that finds low wages, low safety, and workers paying the price, with Peter Waldman, reporter at Bloomberg Businessweek, who wrote the story. It's a tough picture. Lots of jobs have come, and we just heard about that. Alabama needed those jobs. There's lots of talk of an American manufacturing renaissance, but you've got to keep your eye on the edges here. They're pretty wide edges, where that can be awfully tough. You can join us this hour. If a state needs jobs, is this what it takes now? If you need a job, would you take one of these? We're talking 12 hours a day for 7 days a week, sometimes for a long time. Can this country have a manufacturing rebirth that doesn't look third world? What's that going to take? I mean, manufacturing, this is heavy equipment moving around. It is not risk-free. But still, the Peter Waldman reporting in 2015, the chances of losing a finger or a limb in an Alabama parts factory was double the amputation risk nationally for the industry. And that's not a good number. David Michaels joins us in just a moment. He was with OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, until very early this year. Some pretty strong opinions on this. We've got callers as well. John in Minneapolis, Minnesota. John, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Just calling, you know, can we compare the situation here to the book, The Jungle, from the early 20th century, where, you know, the workers in the meat plants basically had the same bad conditions, long hours. Just kind of, what is it going to take? Is it going to take now this Bloomberg report that came out kind of like that book, opening up the whole thing to expect legislation and things like that to fix what happened and what is happening?
John, I'll put that to Peter. I'll put it to David Michaels in just a moment. I mean, our caller, Peter, is not wrong that this can sound just Dickensian. I want to get David Michaels in here, but tell us a couple of more stories first that you've been reporting here. You know, you got Phyllis Taylor, who is making rubber linings for BMW hoods. And the oven that sort of, I guess, baked them had been down, and it was dirty conditions. She slipped on oil and grabbed for the oven, and the door slammed on her hand. Just boom, she still can't use that hand. Or Nathaniel Walker, 26 years old. Tell us his story, if you would, Peter.
Sure. Nathaniel was working for a German company called WKW Erbslow, and they do metal trim parts. He was working on the back line where the big tanks are, where they anodize the metal trim. They dip it in various solutions to give it a hardened coat. And he was a young man just jumping around with full of energy and committed to his job, and was given a certain time frame, usually on weekends, to clean these anodization tanks where they held all the chemicals for dipping. And
they give him 24 hours to clean and service as many as 34 of these acid t- tanks.
Well, 24 was good. You know, that shrank to 12 at one point, and even as low as 6 hours when they were in a real rush. Because remember, this is all about pushing productivity. And when there are real demands, or they're behind on an order, and they're facing a penalty from a parts from a car company, that's when the workers really get the push.
I want to be sure we don't get past these details. You got Walker and his colleague, you say, hopping on and off these 4.5 foot high ventilation shafts, hauling hoses and tools and 50-pound bags of caustic soda, always exhausted. They were working 3 p.m. to 3 a.m., 7 days a week for up to 6 months straight. And they're doing all this work above these vats of acid.
Without any safety harnesses whatsoever. There were no gangways. There were no cables. There were no hitches. There was absolutely nothing. There were no railings even. They were just jumping up and down onto these ventilation shafts. And one day he was standing on one of these things, fixing an empty tank with a crowbar. And behind him was a full tank. So he was sort of balanced in the middle. His hands slipped from the crowbar. He fell backwards into 4.5 feet of acid. Sulfuric and phosphoric acid, literally submerging his entire body. He had to swim. He was flailing for a second to right himself and stand up. And thankfully, there was another worker there who ended up hosing him off. But he did swallow a lot of this stuff, and he ended up in intensive care for 4 days and eventually recovering. He now works at a different plant. But just a horrific story. I think the caller from Minnesota, John, put his finger on it when he likened it to Sinclair Lewis's Jungle, or as you mentioned, Charles Dickens. I mean, this stuff does evoke that kind of, you know, industrial revolution, 18th century England, where no one had any concern for human life in some respects. I wouldn't say that is a blanket statement about every auto parts plant in the South, but there are many where it certainly is accurate.
Peter Waldman, please stand by there in L.A. with Bloomberg Businessweek. David Michaels joins us now from Washington. He's former Assistant Secretary of Labor for the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, OSHA, from 2009 until January of this year. He's now a professor at the George Washington University Department of Health. David Michaels, thank you for joining us.
Hey, hi, Tom. Glad to be on the show.
What's going on here in Alabama? Did you find a fair depiction of these problems in Peter's story? Is this too dark a view? And is this, we hope this is not what more American manufacturing means.
No, I am grateful to Peter Waldman for shining a light on what's going on in factories, not just in Alabama, but across the country. Look, there are 12 deaths every day in the United States workplace, and millions, literally millions of workers are injured every year. OSHA, the organization I ran for more than 7 years, is a very small agency. We've got enough inspectors to visit every workplace once every 145 years.
Wow.
And we saw conditions like this all the time. Not all employers. Many employers want to do the right thing, and the federal government tries to help them get there. But we have far too many employers who are willing to cut corners, really just push on production. And this is really a supply chain issue. You know, we talk about Bangladesh, and just as H&M and Zara have acknowledged they have a responsibility for their clothes to be manufactured in safe factories in Bangladesh, Kia and Nissan, other auto companies have to ensure that their supply chain from Malaysia to Mississippi, all those workers are able to work safely and go home unhurt at the end of their shift. And that isn't going on right now.
Well, what's supposed to happen here? I mean, what we hear from Peter is they just give these huge orders, quotas. We heard him say they're fining people something like $20,000 a minute if they don't reach their production goal. I don't hear a lot about safety. If they're not looking to ensure it, is nobody looking, David?
Well, that's exactly the problem. If Hyundai and Kia and Nissan are saying, we want equipment, we want parts with this exact specification, they're saying, do it any way you can, and there is no storage at their assembly line. So they say they want this many parts delivered at noon tomorrow, and those companies have to put pedal to the metal, and they push production over profits, and workers like Regina pay the cost.
But, I mean, I think Americans assume there's some kind of net here, that workers aren't just out there at the mercy of the production schedule, that there's somebody inspecting or looking out or saying, hey, hold up here, auto parts plant. This is unsafe.
Well, OSHA can help, and when workers call OSHA, we send out inspectors, but OSHA is a small organization. Obviously, look, if people are facing these hazards, they should get the government in there immediately, file a complaint. Don't give up their right, because every American, every worker in American factories has the right to a safe workplace. But as I said, the government's resources are small, and they're being cut back. If you look at what the budget is being considered by Congress, and especially from some of the Republicans from Alabama, they want to handcuff OSHA. And the Trump administration, even though they campaigned on the side of the workers, Donald Trump said he wanted to help American workers. Every action to date has indicated that's not the case.
Let's go to Matthew in Louisville, Kentucky. Matthew, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. It's Matthew from Louisville.
Hi. What do you know, Matthew?
Hi. I'm a union steward, and what I'm calling for is because I know why these states, southern states, attract these companies is because they have horrible workers' comp laws. Like here in Kentucky, they're trying to pass House Bill 296 to gut the workers' comp rights of the employees. When an employee gets hurt in them factories, they have no rights. They can't go after the companies. They can't go back after the companies for their injuries. So, therefore, the company fears nothing. There's no workers' comp laws, hardly, for these employees.
And so when something bad happens, they just have to live with it, Matthew.
Yeah, I mean, they pay for their medical bills, but that's it. They don't get no compensation for their injuries. Like here in Kentucky, House Bill 296, they're trying to gut the workers' comp rights. And the reason why they're doing that, I called my state senator trying to voice our opposition to this law, is because they're doing that, trying to attract more manufacturing jobs to the state of Kentucky. And that's what Alabama has. They have horrible workers' comp laws for the employees.
Matthew,
so therefore, these companies...
They don't face as much risk if somebody is hurt. Peter Waldman, what's the union representation in Alabama?
So I'm glad Matthew raised that. It's more than workers' comp. It's the actual union itself. All of these southern states are right-to-work states where it's very difficult to form a union. There maybe is one unionized auto parts plant among the 160, 170 in Alabama. They are not unionized. And the best example of that is a worker at the Huntsville plant of Mattsu, Alabama, where he was working there, lost a pinky. His name is Courtney, and he lost his pinky working on a press. Eventually got another job at GM just north in Tennessee. He commutes from Alabama, and it's at their big Spring Hill plant, which is unionized. He's now a member of UAW. He got a 50% raise when he moved to that unionized plant. He also got training and a series of protections from shop stewards who walked the floor for the UAW.
Let's go to Daniel in Shelby, North Carolina. Daniel, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my phone call. I am originally from Michigan. My father and grandfather, entire family, had worked in the automotive industry. And when I moved to Shelby, North Carolina, to be closer to my wife's family, I took a job with a large parts manufacturing plant that was unionized, one of the few in this region. And the pay was very good. The overtime was good. The benefits were good. But due to demand, they had a layoff over the past couple of years. And so in the last year, I've taken a new position with a non-unionized parts plant. It's significantly smaller. It's owned by a Chinese conglomerate, but it's operated by Germans. And when this plant opened in North Carolina, part of the way they attracted this company to this region of North Carolina is with tax subsidies and grants. And part of that was supposed to be a coordination between the company and local community colleges to develop and train workers.
Yep.
And working with this company and being in this company, what I see, which I've also seen elsewhere in the region, they have a staff of German technicians who do the vast majority of the technically skilled work. And the proper training of their employees is neglected. And
so what do the Americans do, Daniel? What do the Americans do?
Well, it kills morale, probably more than anything, is because they put Americans in positions who a lot of these Americans have prior experience, and they're prideful in the work that they do, but a lot of the equipment that we work with is foreign. Some of it is even still in German. And technically, according to our employee handbook, the official language of our company is English at this facility. But we have equipment where none of the employees can read it without taking a smartphone and putting up Google Translate and figuring out what the error is. And so what they do is they ship these Germans over for 6 to 8 months at a time, and when something goes wrong or even minor adjustments are made, if the Germans aren't present, we call them in, and if they can't come in, we either stop production or continue to run production, but not at the quality standards that they're supposed to be. And so it's this massive conundrum where they won't train the Americans, which offends the Americans, but at the same time, I assume from the company's point of view, if they stopped to take the time to train the Americans, they would keep losing money. So it's this catch 22 where we need to have the German technicians because the equipment will not be adjusted.
We got it. That is a wild story. I've never heard it in quite that detail before, Daniel, and I really appreciate your call. I mean, Peter Waldman, what do you take away from this? Americans want good jobs. President Trump has promised a resurgence of American manufacturing. But, you know, they don't want to be the cleanup crew that's getting their limbs crushed here, and they want to make a decent wage. How do we tilt this more broadly toward good manufacturing jobs?
Well, it's all about, from a personal standpoint, education. You just got to go out and make yourself as literate as you possibly can. And unfortunately, Daniel sounds like he is and still can't even operate the machinery there because of the language thing. And I don't know. I mean, I don't know exactly what the solutions are. I tend not to think that a bunch of trade tariffs and choking off imports is going to do it. Which, of course, is one of the solutions that Donald Trump basically has.
Yeah. David Michaels, what's your answer to the how do we guard against sort of going Bangladesh at the darker side of our manufacturing profile?
Well, we need minimum standards for safety, and we need minimum standards for workers' compensation and for wages. But those minimum standards have to be far higher than what we currently see. And as long as it's state-based, like the caller from Kentucky said, there's a race to the bottom. Every state is saying, we can make lower costs for you, and you can come in here. You don't have to worry about workers' comp. You don't have to worry about OSHA. And it's really a disaster. The government has to be on the side of the workers, and right now it's not.
When I hear a story like Regina Elsie's and talk to her mom, Angel Ogle, it's just absolutely heartbreaking. People may say, well, manufacturing is a tough business and bad things happen, but you've been with OSHA. Surely that's not the attitude we need to take.
It doesn't have to happen. These high-tech jobs, they can be safe jobs, but if you put production first, workers are going to be hurt. We'll see that story over and over again, and we can do better.
David Michaels, former Assistant Secretary of Labor, heading up OSHA until January of this year. David Michaels, thank you very much for being with us this hour.
Oh, thank you, Tom.
And Peter Waldman, who went out and did the reporting in Alabama that brought in this big, tough report. He's at Bloomberg Business Week, joining us today from Los Angeles. You can read the link to the article at our website, onpointradio.org. Peter Waldman, thank you very much for your work and for being with us today.
Thanks, Tom.
For our listeners in Alabama and everywhere, we wish you well. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.